VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we are both here in the flesh today, as always. Well, there's always at least one of us here in the flesh, but as always, we're entering into the final month of our fifth year doing the show, which is a good time to thank people for listening, because we wouldn't be here if you weren't out there listening. So stay tuned, and in a month we'll enter year six. There's going to be a lot going on in the year 2020, and we'll try to help you weather the ups and downs, which are inevitable at a time like this. But things are good, and despite everything you hear and read, I have nothing but optimism, and that includes after the little tete-a-tete we had with the Iranian and Iraq, and you saw the markets react to that, and then as the day went on, they sort of settled down a little bit and all that, but Adam will get into that in a minute. But first, we will, as always, have a trivia question, and I want to remind everybody that the lines are open, and callers always go to the head of the line. Our number is 904-222-8255 or 222-TALK. Make it easy to remember. And don't know what we have on tap for prizes today, but before I get any further, I have to apologize because last week, about a 16th of a second after we signed off, I remembered I had not given out the exact answer to the trivia question, which was what percentage of Americans overdraw their required minimum distributions every year. The answer was 80, and I was taking a plus or minus one. Larry had checked in at 84, and Marshall, I believe, came in at 80 or 78. So the 79 to 81 was bracketed but not gotten. And I suppose Ken Bale should just say thank you very much for saving me a couple of bucks.
I'll let him know that we saved him some money.
Shall. But he's on the hook again today, and you'll get that right after the break, as always. This week in the market, there was much more excitement than results. That's the way I look at it.
That's a good way of putting it.
Thank you. Well, carry on.
Yeah, 2019 is officially over, and what a year it was. Mm. In the stock market and many other ways, it was a really interesting year, one that we probably won't soon forget, mainly in my job because, wow, the results were fantastic. Heading into 2019, the consensus was not that we would see a 30% rise in the stock market, but rather that we would see a recession, which is kind of the opposite of a 30% rise in the stock market. This could not have been more wrong. And looking back, it almost seems foolish that was it was everywhere. That's all you heard about. We had a pullback going on, and in some cases it even dipped into a bear market territory, depending on which index you looked at. And then all of a sudden, Christmas Day came and everything got better. And
Christmas has that effect sometimes.
It does. And it just stayed that way throughout the duration of 2019. I mean, there really wasn't even a significant fear of a pullback at any point in 2019. And the recession fears and talk just kind of, I mean, they persisted into the summer, but then just kind of dropped off the radar. And now it's rare that you even hear it forecast before 2021 or 22. So really interesting.
Some of the financial writers are trying again, but they're not getting much press.
We're going to see a lot of that this year, my opinion. I mean, especially around election time.
Yeah.
You're going to have the Democrats are going to be saying that it's imminent. Of course, that's all political, has nothing to do with reality, as most political talk goes. So just ignore it. That's our best advice headed into 2020. The actual results, the NASDAQ really led the way. It rose from about 6,600 to over 9,000, a gain of more than 35%. So that it was clearly the best performing index. And that was led by the just never ending rise in technology stocks. I mean, that sector was up more than 40% on the year and is now the largest sector. Well, it has been the largest sector in the S&P 500. Now it's really the largest sector in the S&P 500, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down or losing momentum headed into 2020. Of course, all that can change on a dime, but that's the current situation.
I don't see any slowdown in the technological development either.
No.
I think Moore's Law is alive and well.
Exactly. The more we create, the more innovation it spurs. So it just keeps exponentially getting faster and faster, as do microprocessors and computer chips and
smaller
everything related
and smaller
to that.
And smaller.
And the idea is, I saw recently there's a new TV coming that is a flat screen that unfurls from your ceiling, rolls down. It's just
inevitable.
Insane. Yeah.
Then it'll be in your windows, so you can put whatever you want on your window panes.
The S&P gained just a hair under 29%, and the Dow was the real laggard at just over 22%. And it's hard to even imagine calling 22% the worst performer of any group in the financial sector.
That's what happens when you got one or two stocks that affect the other 28 or 29.
Yeah.
That's why the Dow is such a poor indicator, though we all love it, and I plead guilty.
Yeah, of course. It's the easiest one and most common one to use, but it really is the worst. And you look at certain stocks that are that have really high values just on the number of dollars of per share it takes to buy them, which is absolutely meaningless, but it affects the Dow in a great way if that number's higher, which makes no sense, but that's the way it is. That's why I constantly complain about it. The fourth quarter really solidified the gains for the year, with the Nasdaq adding more than 12%, the S&P almost 10%, and the Dow more than 7%. December didn't see the bulk of those gains, but they were spread pretty evenly over the 3 months. But it wasn't a bad month in any way. The indexes posted gains across the board between 1.7 and 3.5% for the month. This week was a little bit different story. We didn't see gains, more or less, but it certainly looked like we would after Thursday's close. The Dow was up about 300, actually more than 300 points on Thursday. And everything looked to be sailing along pretty smoothly. And then the little incident in Baghdad happened, and we woke up to that news, and the futures that were off about 350 points when I woke up. And so by the time the market opened, though, the reaction was a lot more muted than that. And throughout the rest of the day, we ranged between down 150 and 250, and we ended down a little over 200, at less than 1%. So really, a less than 1% move on major news means that it really wasn't that major news, in my mind. I'm not too worried about it. The only way that I see this, the only party in this little skirmish that this will end bad for will be Iran, and I don't see the U.S. being a major negative benefactor of this little skirmish. I just can't paint a scenario where Iran can do anything that would affect us. Would you agree with that assessment?
I couldn't argue that at all.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to be a big deal.
Saber rattling is everywhere.
Right.
And that includes in the same country. I mean, what the Democrats are doing now when Trump did this, and they, of course, won't mention that Obama did it 563 times. It's just saber-rattling, positioning.
Yeah. I mean, they shot down a drone. We used a drone to shoot down one of their top guys. I mean, it's all in that same little skirmish-type stuff. I have a bunch more about the economy, but I'll get to that after the break.
Okay, and I have a few things that I want to go over today, too. One of the craziest articles of the week I'll get to right after Adam finishes up the market wrap, but why do people write these things? It's beyond me. Don't go anywhere. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have the trivia question brought to you, as always, by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. There's something. Let me introduce this a little differently. Tell you what. I got a series of numbers here for Adam. He's never seen them before. I'm going to see if he can pick up where I'm going here. 494, 623, 800, 767, 990, 473, 1,033, and 5,211.
Is it the Dow on election days in the 70s and 80s or something like that?
No, but you're on the track. There's an ancient stock market expression that I have followed ever since I've been in this business, and it says, if you are not in the market on the best 7 days every year, you will make no money. So at least every other year, I try to do it every year, I look, and I just download the Dow numbers, and I take off the top seven, and lo and behold, all the money was made in those 7 days. And it's true virtually every year.
Hmm.
Not this year. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
You're fine. How are you?
All righty. Do you got, I was looking on y'all's website because I wanted to meet with y'all and kind of get y'all's perspective of what's going on. But do y'all ever meet, do y'all meet with people on the weekends or just during the week?
Yeah, just during the week.
I was going to have to take a day off of work to come meet with y'all. So that's why I was kind of trying to figure out how to,
how to get out
there to where y'all are at.
We try and be flexible during the week, though. If you can't get there till or if early morning works best or late in the afternoon, just call the office instead of using the online scheduling. Just call on Monday, and we can probably figure something out.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to meet with y'all and kind of go over what I've gotten. Hopefully, y'all can get me straightened out.
Great, Mike. That sounds like a good plan. I hope we can help.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Right, bye.
That phone number, by the way, is 904-685-1505.
For the office.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, back to the tradition says that all the money's made in 7 days. And it did not work this year. But what I just read you were the seven worst days. I just didn't put the negative signs on them. But those ranging from 490 or from 473 to 1,033, those were all the down days, the worst down days on the Dow last year. Remember the 1,033?
I don't. That's surprising, but yeah. No.
It's a strange thing anyway. Normally, if I said if you missed the best 7 days, you would have no money. You would have made no money. This year, how much would you have made? I'll take it to the closest half percent. It is a positive number. The theory did not work this year.
Okay.
All right. Back to wrapping up the market.
Yeah. So there are a lot of positives in the market headed into 2020, but there's also a few concerns. The one that keeps coming up and just won't go away is the weakness in the manufacturing sector. It's being reported by the ISM survey, which is a survey of purchasing managers at big companies that gets a feel for whether for the state of their business. Are you buying more? Are you selling more? Where are your inventories? Are you hiring? Are you firing? It is not data dependent. It is all based on responses from purchasing managers. So you can assume that some of them are going back to the data and some of them are just responding based on their feel of their own business, which they spend a great deal of time in. So it is definitely subjective and it is definitely influenced by sentiment. So the data isn't really backing it up. If you look at almost anything, that any of the hard data that would correspond with these categories, you're just not seeing this slowdown of this magnitude that's being reported in this report. And this report has been this way for about four consecutive months, I believe. And this has happened four other times during this bull market where this data report has shown the manufacturing sector to be contracting. And it did that for a few months, and then it bounced right back into expansion. So,
and then jobs are still being created in the manufacturing sector.
Right.
This is called noise when you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. And then personal consumption is rising at an annualized rate of 6.6% per year.
Wow.
Now, there's no way that you can continue to increase consumption at 6.6% while manufacturing is actually being cut. You have to manufacture more to keep up with that type of consumption. Otherwise, you run out of inventory. And at the same time, customer inventories, as reported by the ISM manufacturing report, have been falling for more than a year straight.
Yeah.
I think 17 months now they've been falling. It just doesn't...
That makes no sense.
It makes no sense. If your customers' inventories are falling and you're contracting, shouldn't you be expanding to supply them with more inventory? So the manufacturing sector it's very difficult to decipher right now.
I'll give you a possible contributor to that. This came from our old buddies at Money and Markets on the 23rd of December. Survey, more than half of U.S. CFOs see recession in 2020, 76% say by mid-2021. The CFOs are predicting a recession when nobody else is. Maybe they're convincing the companies to keep their inventories bare bones.
And to some degree, a lot of these CFOs were in place in 2007, 2008, 2009. They've lived through a really bad time. They don't want to be caught with high levels of inventory if we do go into recession. I can see that reaction as...
If you miss sales because your lead times are too long...
No doubt.
Then you are not doing a good job either.
That is correct. So we'll see. We'll see how this all shakes out. But I expect that this ISM index will return to a level above 50. My guess would be in the next 3 to 6 months.
I would think.
This guy says,
I'd expect uncertainty about the election itself to cause firms to slow expansion in the summer and fall of 2020. Really? Never mind.
Okay.
I just love pointing out what I consider abject stupidity based on totally partisan things rather than logic or economics.
Going into 2020, we still see far more positives than negatives. The positives include a strong consumer, employment, Fed keeping rates low. We have a strong housing market. The markets are doing great, and inflation is low. On the negative side, there's definitely some political risk, high valuations, high bullish sentiment, and manufacturing weakness potentially. So in my opinion, there's more positives than negatives.
You got a guess about peak oil price this year?
I mean, could I see it in the 80s? Maybe, but I don't think so.
I'd bet against it.
Yeah, I would bet against it as well.
We have so much control here now because we have become independent. I just don't see this being a really big deal. Now, if Iran really pulls off something stupid and starts blowing ships out of the water in the Strait of Hormuz, I take that back at that point. But I don't think they're that stupid.
I think they could only get one, and then
yeah,
there'd be exactly. A response.
Yeah,
so,
there would be a response, all yeah. Right. So I just don't see it. Right now, you see the uncertainty caused by oil in what were the big winners this week? Gold, silver, and tips.
Yep.
Their inflation protection and alternatives. And I think that was a pretty logical response for people. Tips are up almost 118, by the way. It's been a long time since I've seen that happen. So people are definitely looking at this and they're being a little cautious. Will it blow over without a shot being fired? I couldn't say.
No, it's hard to say. I mean, a shot's already been fired, but will it escalate into anything more?
I really don't know either.
It depends. Trying to guess what Iran is going to do is effort in futility.
No, that's for sure. All right. Got a couple minutes. But this week's headlines, my favorites. This morning, U.S. farmers see another bleak year despite Phase 1 trade deal. How many farmers did they quote?
One.
Absolutely right. And he didn't know what he was going to do.
Okay.
Very much undecided. And the reason, they said, was because the China deal was not signed yet.
That's fair.
It is. But both sides have announced that it will be on the 15th.
Yeah, that's true. We'll see if it happens. We're all thinking it will.
Yeah. Now, if that goes ahead as scheduled, I don't see another bleak year in farming.
The other thing about farming is that they paint two sides of a story, and they're very different. One is that the farming being done has hurt all these little farmers throughout the Midwest. The other times, they show that 99% of farms are owned by giant corporations anyway. Mm-hmm. So which is it? Is there a bunch of small farmers in the Midwest, or are 99% of farms owned by big corporations?
A couple hundred years ago, over 90% of the population was in some way, shape, or form attached to food production, grain production, farming, in other words. And now it's under 4%, I think. There are more people who work for the Department of Agriculture than there are farmers today.
Makes
Explain
sense.
That someday. All right, but the big one, it will take the average worker a record 114 hours to buy one share of the S&P 500. Again, brought to you by those geniuses at MarketWatch. And I have but two words to say about that. So what? Let's talk about buying a share of the S&P 500 index share, the SPY. You can't buy an index, people. It's just a stack of numbers. This is the stupidest thing I've ever read. And it's written for the most obvious reason that you could imagine. Because they're trying to make damn sure that Trump gets no credit for doing anything right. And that's it. I got a couple of alternatives here for right after the break. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. We'll pay some bills. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is, even if you missed the best 7 days of this year, you still made money on, based on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. What percentage would you have earned even missing out on those goodies? Adam and I were talking on the break about some just general stuff. The tax brackets have been redone. I've got some information on them now. And even though the tax brackets, first off, the tax rates stayed the same. But the tax brackets are broader than they used to be. They got indexed for inflation. And the numbers now, because of the new broad brackets, are so big that even a little bit means quite a lot of money. So when you get up to a married couple who wants to stay in the 12% tax bracket, you can earn now with your new standard deduction $103,350 and still not get over the 12% bracket.
Now, is that
That's taxable income.
No, but is that for under...
Under 65.
Under 65, yeah.
Yes, and you can add another $2,600 to that if you're both over 65, $1,300 if one of you is. And that's on your standard deduction. Well, you're going to see now the number of people itemizing continue to drop precipitously. But why is this important? I'm so glad I asked. This is important because if you make capital gains that are taxable along the way, you can get those capital gains free by staying in that 12% bracket. This is called income planning, and we do a lot of it among our clientele.
This is where a Roth IRA or a brokerage account can come in very handy for supplementing your RMDs.
Yeah. And if you're using your retirement plans and you're pulling money out every month and you're keeping track of how much money you made and you're afraid you might go over a little bit, but you do have a Roth, but you need more money, simply take it from the Roth. It does not become taxable to you, and you can save yourself a bundle if you have any fairly significant capital gains. This is not called cheating. This is called knowing and understanding and using the system, and that's part of what we do. So that was all good. HSA changes, another one that came up in the office this week, and it was kind of a shame, but it did. How many of you do know about health savings accounts? Probably a fairly decent percentage of them. All that means is you have a private health insurance policy with a high deductible. And on the side of that, you have an account called an HSA, which in many ways resembles an IRA. The money you put into it is taxable. The only codicil on it is it has to be used, if at all, for medical expenses. You do not have to use it. It's not like a Section 425 cafeteria plan where you either use it by December 31 or you lose it. It can sit there and accumulate. So if you're youngish and have pretty good cash flow and you're not really all that sick and don't have big medical expenses, you just keep chugging along with your HSA account and you leave it rolling over. And when you're 65, it becomes another IRA. And again, you can use it for your medical expenses. And I promise you, once you hit 65, you will have some medical expenses.
That, no doubt about it.
Been there for a while and counting them up. So this is an unfortunate thing that they didn't change to me. They kept the limit. They didn't change anything. They kept the limit of age 65. And then the year you turn 65, you're only allowed to contribute pro rata for the months before you turn 65. And after that, you're done using it. And I've been upset about that since I was a much younger person, but I can be upset about it, but I would be fined and taxed if I did it wrong. So I guess you better probably follow the book, huh?
Good advice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they missed the boat there, but what the heck. 401k contributions are up a bit. They added $500 for the year, and the IRA catch-up is a $7,000 total, $6,000 for non-age 55 people. So it's a 50-50, non-age 50 people.
50.
Yeah. I don't know why that came out 55. It's crazy. Of course, the health insurance penalties, that which is known as Obamacare, the penalty for not doing something, it was effectively emasculated a year ago or 2 years ago when Trump lowered the tax rate on that penalty to zero. Now they finally addressed reality and threw it out. So there is no need anymore under penalty of law or tax to not buy or to buy health insurance. So there's some good things that came down the pike, and I kind of like it. Oh, I wanted to back up one thing, too. If you want to add up the hours it takes a regular old worker to buy something, I got an idea, Congress. Let's figure out how many hours they have to work to pay their income taxes.
Tax Freedom Day.
That usually is out around May something.
Yeah, and it keeps, well, it was getting worse for a while, and yeah, I think it got better.
I'm wondering now if Tax Day and Tax Freedom Day are going to be close together.
I think it actually started, I think it started going backwards, so under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017.
That's very possible, actually. That's something I've definitely got to look into. All right, we were talking a lot about Roth IRAs lately, and, you know, this it's that time of the year when, like it or not, you can see April 15th right out your windshield, and that means you got to start doing some thinking. A lot of things you should have thought about should have been thought about last year, but not everything. And one of the things that you can think about after the first of the year is your IRAs, because they do not require the contribution for last year to be made until you file your tax returns or April 15th, whichever is later. Earlier. Nobody even knows that, though. It's April 15th. That's what everybody says. You can do it till then. Well, what if you don't have the money to fund your Roth, but you really want to do it? What if it's a traditional one, and it would give you a bigger deduction, so therefore you get more money back? Because, by the way, something everybody should know, when you put money in an IRA, it is not an itemized deduction. It's what we call an above-the-line deduction. In other words, it just flat out lowers your income for everybody. It's just income you don't have to claim, so it'll never be taxed. But what if you need more? You can still do that money into the IRA after the first of the year. Likewise, if you maybe have some back and you've been wanting to save some money and haven't had a real good time doing it, you can also do that with a Roth IRA. And right there on the tax form, when you send it in, you can tell them, direct this refund, all or part of it, to my IRA, either regular or Roth, and you can fund it without having your hands on the money because, you know, the old expression, out of sight, out of mind, it's particularly true with money. So that's one of the things that's a really, really good provision. And if you haven't started, or if you're started but you have had trouble contributing, remember that when it comes tax time, you might be able to help yourself doing that. If you use a preparer, bring it up with the preparer. The problem with Roths, aside from, of course, the tax deductibility, which is only a problem in the short run, the problem with Roths is that so many people make so many mistakes when they're investing their Roth IRA money. That one of the major ones that we see is confusing the account with the investment. A Roth IRA is the name of an account that can be held in many, many different places. And a CD is a certificate of deposit, which are issued by banks, credit unions, and the like. But far too often we hear, should I buy a Roth IRA or a traditional? And what they're meaning is that their bank or credit union said that they should put that money in an IRA, which would only be in a CD because they aren't allowed to invest that money. If you have an interest-bearing account for your Roth or your traditional IRA, I would suggest that you are erroring on the side of caution big time. You want risk in your financial life, and you want to do it in the way that'll hurt the least and benefit the most. There is no better place to put risk, and by risk I mean equities over bonds or cash. There's no better place to put risk in your financial investing life than in a Roth IRA. Why? Well, let's say it hits and you take it out later. You've made a big gain and you never pay taxes on it. But if it doesn't, you put all your risk in a place where it isn't going to hurt the rest of it much. It is just an absolutely ideal place to invest with risk. We call that investing too cautiously. The other thing is failure to maximize your contribution. If you're going to use it, why not put as much in there as you possibly can? If you need to withhold, if you need to change your withholding on your paycheck so you have a little extra cash to put in there, it's really easy. Go to the employer and tell them. Another good thing, you never have to take a required minimum distribution from it. So even if you get older and don't need the money, instead of getting rid of that IRA slowly, you can keep it. A couple more things right after the break. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And this segment brought to you by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance. Call Troy at 662-9794. Lines are open. Trivia question is still unanswered. How much percentage-wise would you have made in the Dow, even if you missed the best 7 days, which usually would have taken you to zero? All right, I wanted to wrap up the Roth IRA. The power, the true power of wealth building in a Roth has two components to it. You have to maximize both your lifetime contributions and your investment risk. We know the difference, the trade-off between risk and reward. You put your riskier investments in there, you're probably going to wind up with a lot bigger account at the end. That is the compounded compounding, you might say, because you get to add to it. Which brings me to one of the dumber articles I've ever seen in my life. And it says the Roth IRA could become self-funding. Really?
What?
Your Roth IRA could become self-funding.
Well, isn't it by definition self-funding because you are responsible for funding it?
You have a point there. The premise of the article was if you build it large enough and invest it well enough, it might earn more money in the year than you're allowed to add to it. But that's not funding. That's called investment results. Funding comes from one source, you. It can't be self-funding except in the manner that Adam described it. Yes, I'll fund it myself.
And if your 401k gets big enough, it could earn more than you can deposit as well in a year.
That's right.
I mean, so what?
People, if you get space to fill up in an article, I guess you have to, right?
I guess.
Oh, it's funny. All right, all of you parents with younger children out there, this one came to my attention recently by my erudite research department. There is a website called freemoneybrightvideo.com, which we plan to check out a little more just to be sure because neither of us has seen the actual DVD. But freemoneybrightvideo.com is an offering that Mike Huckabee has online right now for a free kids DVD to introduce your kids to the topic of money and handling it. And everyone who's familiar with Huckabee knows what a kind of everybody's grandfather, Gentle Ben, smart, wonderful guy he is. I can imagine this would be really, really good. So I did go to the website. Couldn't find a link to watch it, but I didn't have but a minute. And for the whopping sum of $1 for postage, he will send you the DVD. We will try to get a report on it between now and next week and see. But I think this is something that people could sink their teeth into on behalf of their children. Because let's face it, they don't learn it in school.
No, unfortunately, there was something bouncing around the Florida legislature earlier this year about requiring kids to take a financial literacy class, but it kind of I haven't heard anything about since it got introduced. It might have died in committee or something like that.
Most things do in the first session anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, Ron DeSantis is a an advocate for a lot of the things that you and I believe in.
I'm pretty sure he was behind it and would be behind it. I'm just not sure what happened with it. It might be something they're going to address this year, hopefully.
Well, a lot of things like that can't make it on their own, but they get attached to spending bills and what have you. It's the way of the world in politics. Mm-hmm. All right, there's some things that we need to watch for out there that would be very detrimental in my mind, and they're flowing around. It all involves exchange-traded funds. Those of you who have dealt with us long enough absolutely know what exchange-traded funds are. They're essentially the same thing as a mutual fund, which is a big bowl of assets of various types. Only the mutual fund is traded differently. It's only traded back and forth between the company and you. The exchange-traded fund has a similar share, but it's put out on the exchanges, and it's sold from person to person. So I could buy from Adam, and he could buy from you, and long about like that. But those aren't the primary differences in the ETFs. The ETFs have some extremely good features to them when it comes to taxation and so on. But one of the things about ETFs, which are frequently referred to as index shares, because all of the early ETFs were exactly that, they were index shares, and a lot of them still are. So if you want, say, the S&P 500, if you want to buy that, you buy a share of something called SPY, which is basically the representation of all of the stocks in the S&P 500 in the right proportion.
Cap-weighted.
Yeah, cap-weighted. But the debut is imminent for non-transparent, actively managed ETFs. And my radar go up when I read non-transparent, actively managed ETFs. That means you don't know what's in that thing day to day. And they're not obligated to tell you how they're moving it around.
Yeah, but I get it. I get why they do that. Mutual funds have long histories of doing that, and some of the most popular mutual funds in history are like that.
When I want professional management, I am still old-fashioned enough to go to the mutual fund industry.
I don't think the wrapper matters. I'd prefer to have it in an ETF, and I'm okay with that.
I think you have to take a really good look, like you would in any mutual fund, at the manager and the track record of the manager.
Of course. That goes without saying. In any investment of that style,
I will allow for the possibility that this might turn out okay. But my antenna went up really fast.
No, I'm okay with it. I think it was the next logical step. Why keep those active managements in a less efficient version
I worry
of the
about
same thing?
Trading costs and just basic people that aren't doing it right. And I'm just old. You know, that's the difference in outlook between a guy who's 69 and a guy who's 49?
49? What are you, adding years?
I was just seeing if you were paying attention.
I'm pretty sure I came along after you were married. So.
Quite a while after, actually. All right, the tax efficiency of ETFs are also getting threatened. The pass-through nature of the capital gains might be changing. What happens is when an ETF has to sell, let's go back first. When a mutual fund has to sell things because people are redeeming their shares, those capital gains from selling are captured. And once they're captured, they're reported, and the remaining owners and the new owners of the fund will be accruing those for the end of the year. The ETFs use something called in-kind transactions, which are not considered cash and do not result in pass-through capital gains. That means owning them over time is a much less taxable event than it is for the mutual funds. If they lose that, I'm going to be very unhappy. Fordham University of Law Professor Jeffrey Colon has called for the repeal of Section 852(d)(6) of the Internal Revenue Code, which allows for the tax-free distribution of capital gains in ETFs. Thanks,
yeah.
Professor.
Really?
You idiot.
But on what basis?
He calls it the great ETF tax swindle.
So who's getting swindled?
The government.
Oh, darn. I mean, why is that a bad thing?
Because this is based on the premise among so many academics that all money is government money and they can allow you to keep whatever they want. How about that?
Yeah, I would disagree with that.
Yeah, he says it causes the government to forfeit money. Forfeiting money implies that you own it. I'm not going to that law school. A heartbeat trade. You know what a heartbeat trade is?
Never heard of it.
Heartbeat trade is when they need to rebalance an ETF, so the index rebalances or whatever. The restructuring of global industry classification standard is changing, maybe. And what it's going to result in is they do these things tax-free. They make a pile of this and a pile of that and a pile of that, and they swap them instantaneously, and they're tax-free exchanges, which get, again, they accrue to the ETF owners. So it's a good thing. Vanguard invented something years ago called a heartbeat trade, a Vanguard style, where they do the same kind of rebalancing, but they do it between their mutual fund division and their ETF division. That's why you're seeing the ETF division grow so big at Vanguard, because they are now used to offset each other, and that's all tax-free. But their patent runs out in 2023.
Gotcha.
And
well, you're seeing the ETF division grow because they're wildly more popular because it's a better product.
Exactly, and maybe by then it won't make a bit of difference. Also, they've eliminated a lot of the barriers to having new ETFs come out, which is also a good thing. Just some things to watch. Okay, if you had missed the best 7 days this year, you would still have taken 8 1/3% home on the Dow Jones. That's very rare, folks. That's the first time I've ever seen it. Also, if you missed the worst 7 days, which is supposed to absolutely knock the socks off, you only would have made 44%. The conclusion is very simple. This was a year of negligent or no volatility in the market.
Yeah, very absolutely.
Strange. See you next week. This is the Ben Wee Financial Hour.